real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hey friends, welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Our goal here every single day is to help you reconnect the eternal with the everyday and enter into the conversations of the day in ways that honor Jesus. So we're trying to seek the mind of Christ on the matters of the day. We're trying to take the headline news of the day and figure out how we as Christians should be engaging in the conversations of the day. Like, how are we going to do that? So I'm going to lead off today with a conversation with the Associate Director of Research for Pew Research, because there's a headline out there that really caught my attention, and it's a conversation about why Americans either go to church or don't go to church. And actually, the bigger conversation is, why do Americans either go or not go to religious services? And as soon as we broaden the conversation in that way, it makes us more interesting conversation partners, because it's not just about, hey, why are there fewer people in my local church? It's a larger conversation about religion in America and what we and our neighbors are doing and why we're doing what we're doing. So many of you probably saw in the Minneapolis paper, I don't know, a couple of weeks ago, an article about the declining attendance and closure of churches across the region. But we want to expand that conversation nationally. And if we did so, we would find that many houses of worship are struggling to keep their doors open because a rising percentage of U.S. adults don't attend worship services on a regular basis. And the percentage who attend rarely or never is growing pretty rapidly. So what keeps people coming or what keeps them away? To answer that question, we're talking today with Greg Smith, Associate Director of Research for Pew. Greg, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so let's jump right in. What did those who regularly attend worship services give as their primary reason?
It's very interesting. People cite a variety of reasons for why they attend religious services, for what keeps them coming back, so to speak. Lots of people, for example, say they attend religious services to help instill their children with a good moral foundation, or to make themselves a better person, or for comfort in times of trouble and sorrow. So people give a lot of reasons for why they go to religious services, but there's really one reason that stands out above them all, and that is to become closer to God. 80% of people who attend religious services regularly say they do so to become closer to God, and nothing else really even comes close.
That's pretty staggering. I mean, if you consider the number of people that we're talking about, or the percentage of the population that we're talking about, and that motivation, I think that's a significant finding. You also found that smaller majorities say that valuable sermons or being part of a community of faith were also important reasons for their regular religious attendance. I thought that the list of reasons was extremely interesting. Did you discover anything in terms of like generational commitment or family tradition, or like, hey, I go because my family's always been this or that?
Yeah, there is some of that. You know, one of the things we were interested in is knowing how many people go to church for some of the, you might think of them as ancillary benefits for the community that they might encounter there, or for various kinds of tangible benefits they might get from attending religious services. And there is a lot of that. About a third of people say one of the very important reasons they go to religious services is to continue their family's religious traditions. Or one in five say they go to meet new people or to socialize. A similar share say they go to please a family member, like a spouse or a partner. So there are people who give those reasons. Those are important. I don't want to downplay their importance, but they don't come close to the share who say, you know what keeps me coming back? It's my desire to become closer to God.
Okay, so if you're listening to Greg and I, and you're thinking to yourself, hey, I would like to tell them why I go, I want you to text me at 877-933-2484, and I want you to answer this question. Why do I go to church? This is why I go to church, or whatever religious service you attend. And if you don't go, now I'm even more interested. If you do not regularly attend religious services, I want you to text me, again, 877-933-2484, and tell me why you don't go, because I'm fascinated in that answer as well. If email is a better option for you, that's Carmen@myfaithradio.com. So, Greg, I also know that you guys at Pew Research, and again, let's tell people that the research is available at pewforum.org. You're looking for why Americans go to religious services. Tell people what you heard from the folks who do not attend regularly. Why don't they go?
Yes, people who don't go to religious services regularly, which is a growing share of the population, as you mentioned, in the United States today, they give a variety of reasons. There's no one reason that jumps out as the key reason that keeps people away from religious services. There are some people, about a third of people who seldom or never attend religious services, about a quarter of people who seldom or never attend religious services say, you know what, it's because I'm just not a believer. But a third of people who seldom or never attend religious services say, it's not a matter of non-belief, it's just that I practice my faith in other ways. About one-fifth of people who don't go to religious services regularly say that logistical reasons keep them away. One-third say there's things they dislike about particular congregations, like they just don't like the sermons, or they don't feel welcome, or they haven't found a church or a house of worship that they like in their area. So there's no one reason that stands out for why people stay away from church. Rather, they give a variety of reasons. I think the key thing to take away from that is that it's only a minority of non-churchgoers who say it's a matter of belief, that a lack of faith is what keeps them away.
I thought the findings in this part of the survey were fascinating, because I think that regular church attenders and or church leaders, like those who are like highly invested in the ongoing institutional reality of the local church, probably imagine all kinds of things about why people aren't coming. And what you all have given, you've given really a real gift in terms of something very tangible, research-based, that that the leaders of a church, let's say, you know, the board of deacons or the elders, the session, they could actually take this research, they could sit down in a meeting and they could say, now look, attendance has been on the decline. We actually thought it was because our pastor is a poor preacher. This actually says that that's not why people aren't coming. So let's stop, you know, ribbing this guy over here, and let's actually start talking about, do our people have an access problem? Like, are there people who would come if we made it easier for them to get here? Are there people with, you know, special needs, or are there people with, you know, there are reasons that people are prohibited from coming? That, to me, was sort of the astonishing takeaway in this.
Yes, there's certainly a lot of people who cite logistical reasons, logistical difficulties, sometimes even physical difficulties with getting to religious services as one of the key reasons that they don't attend more. For example, you have about 1 in 10 people who don't attend religious services who say, it's a matter of time. I just don't have time to get there. A similar share say, I don't go because I am in poor health or it's otherwise difficult for me to get around. And I thought this was really interesting. 7% of respondents who don't go to religious services regularly say it's an access issue, that there is not a church or a congregation from their denomination or their religion in their area, and that's what keeps them away. So yes, logistical difficulties, logistical hurdles are a big part of what's going on here for a lot of people.
So again, friends, I'm talking with Greg Smith from Pew Research. You can check out what we're talking about at pewforum.org. The research you're looking for is Why Americans Go to Religious Services. Greg, I want to dig around a little more. It's hard to ask this question because I was fascinated by the fact that a quarter of the people who don't go to religious services on a regular basis refuse to answer the question why.
I think you've struck on something that's very interesting psychologically. I'm often struck by this. You know, it could be, first of all, you're right to point out that one quarter of people who don't attend religious services didn't say that any of the reasons that we asked about in our survey were very important for what keeps them away. Now, it could be that there's some kind of hurdle or obstacle that we just didn't ask about that is important for people. That could be part of what's happened here. I also think part of what you're seeing here, though, is that for many people, I think it can be hard to explain what is behind the absence of something. I hope that makes sense. It can be hard for people to explain why they are something they are not. I think in some ways it's easier for people to explain why they do certain things or why they are a particular kind of person, and much harder for them to explain why they don't do something or why they are not a particular kind of person.
which I think we would say is probably kind of positive, that folks understand what motivates them, what in the positive direction in terms of identity and belonging and why they're doing things, versus what are all the things that I'm defining myself as being against or in.
That's right. And you could, I think that's exactly right. You could imagine, for example, a person who was not raised in a religion, was not raised in a religious home, has never been a particularly religious person. There was never a time where they attended a church that they've since left. And for that person, this might be a hard question to point to a particular reason or another. Going to church is just perhaps something that they've never done. It's not that there's any particular reason that's driven them away. It's just something that they've never been involved in.
All right, friends, this is Greg Smith. He's also done some really interesting delving into conversations like the nuns and the rise of the nuns, N-O-N-E-S, in our culture and in the conversations at the intersection of sort of religion and not really politics so much, but religion and why we engage in the conversations we engage in. So you should check him out. You should certainly check out this research at pewforum.org. Greg, thank you for being with us here today on Connecting Faith.
It's my pleasure. Great to be with you.
Hey, friends, I got to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Hey, friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I am joined in conversation today by Rachel Marie Stone. And we're going to talk about her latest book, but we are also going to talk about her, and we're going to talk about her experience, and we're going to talk about other things that she's written. But the book that we're discussing today is Birthing Hope, Giving Fear to the Light. So first of all, welcome to Connecting Faith. It's a delight to have you with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you know, you're an acclaimed author. Folks will recognize Eat with Joy. They will recognize the More with Less cookbook. I think this book is going to come as a surprise to people. This is very much a memoir. Tell us about Birthing Hope and I think maybe the motivation to write it.
So Birthing Hope didn't start out as a memoir. It started out, I even found some of my notes from the other day, from maybe 6 years ago. And what I thought I was going to write was with a pretty straightforward nonfiction book about the history of spirituality as it interacts with childbirth, so fairly academic. And then as I was kind of researching this book and thinking about it, I realized that where the power is in birth stories is really like in personal stories, and that what does everybody like really? Everyone likes really to hear personal stories, you know, not necessarily just mine, but the stories that we gravitate toward are stories where people face some sort of a struggle and overcome it. So it began to take just a different shape. Where I wanted to explore theological themes, I wanted to explore the history of childbirth and cultural practices around it. I wanted to explore the history of spirituality and childbirth, but I wanted to sort of do that through telling some of my own stories.
So I think that maybe from here the best place to go is just to invite you to tell us one of your stories. Because I think that what listeners appreciate is getting a sense of what's in there. If I go and get a copy of Birthing Hope, what am I going to find?
Sure. So I think maybe the best story to tell would be a story that begins at the beginning, not of my life, but at the book. And so what happened was and am an English teacher, and I was at the time teaching English in Malawi, which is in sub-Saharan Africa, and it's one of the poorest countries in Africa. And so I was teaching English there, but I was also volunteering at the hospital, the local hospital, and I was volunteering as a birth doula. So not a midwife, just a person who would accompany women who are in childbirth and offer support. So, of you know, physical support and emotional support. So while I was there, I, through a series of events, long story, I ended up catching a newborn baby girl in my own bare hands with no gloves on. And then it turned out that that the mother was HIV positive. And guess what? I had gotten her blood all over my hands. And I even had some cuts on my hands. So I ended up needing to take some the preventative antiretroviral, so the HIV meds, basically. And what that brought up for me was a lot of things, which is like the fact that, you know, this woman and I, we are so, so different, come from totally different worlds almost, and yet we could be connected. And it also brought up the idea that in seeking connection and in seeking to help, we do open ourselves up to risk. And as it happens, I had kind of a long history growing up as a kid in 1980s New York City. I was very aware of AIDS and HIV from a very young age, and I had a lot of phobias that kids of that time, like, for example, and this is absolutely awful, but I can remember we would play tag, you know, at school, and, you know, you'd tag someone and say, like, you have AIDS. It was like a joke, but also it was, you know, something that we feared. So,
well, and I think, Rachel... Sort of Yeah, I think, Rachel, to give that a little context, because, you know, like you say, that's awful, and that might come as a shock to some people who did not grow up in that same time period and did not grow up in environments where there was enough interaction between enough different kinds of people that mm-hmm. folks were even using language. But if we think about cooties and we think about what's the one, the ring around the rosy, pockets full of posies, I mean, that was to dispel the Black Death. So I do think that children tend to integrate into their games all kinds of social commentary. And so I appreciate I mean, like, I really appreciate you lifting that up. I mean, kids will do all kinds of things because they're trying to, in their play, interpret what's happening in the world around them and process their fear and their anxiety. And that's one of the things I so appreciate about this book, because in Birthing Hope, you're really talking about the reality of shared experiences, birth being an experience that no matter what sort of socioeconomic category, no matter what nation you're born in, no matter what religious group you're from, if you're going to have a baby, this is how it's going to come. And I just appreciated how sort of leveling out that experience is in this book.
Yeah, it is. Birth is a great leveler. And it's so amazing. Like, on Mother's Day, I try to post something on social media like this. You know, a lot of us have a complicated relationship with our mothers, right? Some of us, Mother's Day is very painful for a lot of reasons. But at the very least, we can all at least say this. We would not be here if a woman had not, you know, essentially been our house for the first 9 months of our existence. So it is an amazing thing to consider. Like, we all live in very different kinds of houses, but our first house is the same. It's a woman's body, and there's no way to get around that. Like, you know, we don't grow babies in boxes or test tubes, at least not from beginning to end.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, friends, my conversation partner is Rachel Marie Stone. She writes about all kinds of things, and the book that we're talking about today is Birthing Hope, Giving Fear to the Light. And if you are interested in entering a drawing, you can text me at 877-933-2484. We've got some copies to share with listeners today. So again, the best way to do that is to text. You can call also, 877-933-2484. So Rachel, this is not your first book. And so I'm kind of curious to know what your experience has been as people have engaged with this book, which is so very different than what you've written prior to this.
Well, yes, it is, and no, it isn't. I mean, I did have a friend. Yes, it is different. That is to say. And then no, it isn't, because I think there is a common thread. I did have a friend who knows my work very, very well. Ellen Painter Dollar, also a writer. She said that my book, that Birthing Hope, was maybe like Eat with Joy, but for bodies and birthing. And I don't know if that's entirely.
No, that's good.
It's a
that's
a different book. Yeah,
That's an interesting way of thinking about it. Yeah.
Well, because what she said was like, and I think she might be right. Eat with Joy isn't a particular diet plan. It's a way of thinking about food theologically and practically. But you know, it's like brings a theological story, if you will, to why we eat and how we eat and with whom we eat and what we eat. And so, Birthing Hope is like that sort of, but it's about living with bodies that sometimes break down, living with minds that play tricks on us, living with uncertainty, which we all do. So I think readers who know my writing will see this book. It's definitely a sadder, less, I don't know, it's a less cheerful book than Eat With Joy, but there's still hope, as in the title. But
yeah.
It's definitely like, you know, I'm a sadder and a wiser girl in that book than I was 5 years ago with Eat With Joy.
So that's an interesting, you know, observation to make about yourself. And I think that that the more we experience the suffering and injustice of the world, even if it is vicariously through the injustice suffered by others, we become more serious. And so, you know, I think I'm holding out hope that those of us who are Christians will leverage whatever influence we have to be people who are bearing witness to the reality that, you know, Christ reigns. Like he's risen from the dead, and that means he reigns. And so how can I, as a Christian, advance the kind of justice that Jesus would advance were he here? Because by the power of the Spirit, he is here. And so that's one of the things that really, you know, I don't know that it leaps off the page, but it is woven into what's going on here in Birthing Hope. And that is a recognition of human suffering, an observation about global issues that, you know, I think oftentimes we get very focused on what's happening here in the United States, and we sort of fail to remember that maternal health here is not what it is everywhere else. So let's pause there. Let's hit the pause button. Friends, we got to take a quick break, but when I come back, I'm going to continue my conversation with Rachel Marie Stone. We are talking about Birthing Hope, giving fear to the light. So you are listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge, and we'll be right back. Friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. I am joined in conversation today by author and speaker Rachel Marie Stone. She is the author of Eat With Joy. She's also the editor of the newly revised More With Less cookbook. And what we're talking about today is her newest book, and that's Birthing Hope, Giving Fear to the Light. You can follow her on Instagram at Rachel Marie Stone, and you can find her online at rachelmariestone.com. Rachel, again, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Thanks so much for having me.
So one of the words that might be unfamiliar to some folks who are listening is a word that you actually used early in the conversation, and it's really significant in terms of your experience in all of this, and that's the word doula. Can you explain to people what a doula is and what a doula does?
Sure. So a doula is a childbirth companion. Now, sometimes people confuse doulas with midwives, but the difference between doulas and midwives is pretty vast. So midwives take on the role that an obstetrician takes and is responsible for all that health, keeping the mother and the baby healthy throughout the pregnancy and birthing process. Doulas are entirely non-medical, but what we do is we accompany women who are in labor. Well, and there's different doulas. Sometimes a doula will be your postpartum doula and take care of you after you have a baby. But labor doulas stay with a woman through all of her labor and the delivery, and are there. We hesitate to use the word coach because it's not appropriate for a various number of reasons, but a lot of people do think of us as like labor coaches. So personal labor support person is what you can think of a doula as.
Okay, so for a person in the United States of America listening to this, they're saying, okay, well, why would I need one of those? Or they're saying to themselves, wow, there's already a lot of people in that room. So take us to Malawi. Take us to the context in which, you know, you're serving as a doula, and take us into the experience of those women. And because it's absolutely, it could not be more different than the experience of women here in the United States. So I'd love it if you'd take us there.
Sure. So I forgot to mention one of the hallmarks of a doula's care, which is that it's consistent. So in other words, yes, you'll have a labor and delivery nurse, but she'll also have 3 other clients that she's taking care of at the same time. But the doula is there just for you and doesn't leave your side. And that's a really powerful thing for a lot of people, for a lot of women, to not be left alone in that process and to have someone who, you know, you can say, I'm feeling this. Is that normal? And the doula will say, yes, it's normal. Or, you know what, let's maybe call the midwife back in and see if everything's okay. So that being said, in the U.S., you don't necessarily have your one person by your side. And in Malawi, you definitely don't have your one person by your side, because at least in the public hospital, the government-run hospital, the care was extremely inconsistent in terms of how many midwives would be there to take care of, you know, any number of women who might be giving birth at one time. The ward where I occasionally volunteered had maybe 20 beds, and there would be maybe 5 midwives, so not a bad ratio. But I was told, I never did see this with my own eyes, I was told that sometimes all the beds would fill up and they would just be, women would just be basically giving birth on the floor. But in terms of cleanliness, it was not up to a standard that any of us would recognize as safe. There's running water to wash hands most of the time. There was bar soap, and there were no paper towels, no any kind of towels, no sheets on the beds. And midwives did have gloves, and there's no pain relievers, and very, very bare bones. That being said, you know, to be giving birth in a hospital is a step up for a lot of the women there.
So I too have been to Malawi, and when I was there, we were working with a ministry that receives abandoned or newly orphaned infants. So it's a crisis nursery.
Oh.
And so my experience of women in Malawi, in every case, the woman died, and the babies lived if there was someone to, in some cases, you know, immediately, you know, like kangaroo them, in some cases, yeah, immediately insert a feeding tube, like, you know, all kinds of things. And so I think that to help the American listener understand that women around the world are engaging in not only what we take as something that we choose or not choose, but also something that we expect to be attended as a medical event, and something that we expect to be fairly sterile, and result in you know, being able to leave the hospital almost immediately with a little bundle of Well, you know what? I think, Rachel, we expect it to look like Kate makes it look in England when she comes out 2 days after having a baby, and she's in a white dress and she already looks like she's all fit again, and she's in high heels and her hair is okay. So I think that part of what I really appreciate about this book is that although birth is absolutely a profoundly hopeful act, it is happening around the world in every kind of circumstance that we can imagine and in many circumstances that we as Americans absolutely cannot imagine. So talk about the sort of profound act of hope that birth is into a world that we all know is hurting and sinful.
Well, I mean, that's just it. We have no guarantees at any step of the process in becoming pregnant and carrying a baby and giving birth and raising that baby. We have all these advice books, and we have in the West, you know, lots of prenatal care, and we have our prenatal vitamins and prenatal yoga and all the things. But we think by, you know, optimizing our diet or, you know, engaging in the right sort of exercise or whatever it is, we think that we have some control over the outcome, that we can produce the quote unquote perfect baby, that we can, you know, optimize our baby's intelligence by eating the right foods. But the truth is we have, you know, as in so many things, we actually have very little control. And that's a really scary thing to come face to face with. And you see that in places where people don't have the material resources to sort of bolster up their expectations of what's going to happen. You know, when women don't have access to enough iron-rich foods or even iron supplements to avoid anemia during pregnancy, you see that when a woman gives birth, she is, you know, very, very tangibly taxing her own health for the sake of someone else, which is, which can be a beautiful and noble thing. And it also can be a really terrifying thing, especially, you know, in contexts like sub-Saharan Africa, where abuse of women is shockingly common and very much tolerated, and where women often don't have a choice in terms of whether and when to get pregnant. And so it's hopeful because even in terrible, terrible circumstances, or circumstances that from the outside look terrible, you see women receiving their babies with joy and looking with hope to what that child's life is going to be. Now, I think it would be overly optimistic and it would be foolish to be naive about the hope that birth represents. I think birth is very, you know, it's ripe with symbolism, but I think there's also like a hard-headed practical obligation to, you know, materially improve the lives and circumstances of women around the world when it comes to this issue.
So we're gonna actually talk in a different segment of this same show about the substantive ways that that Americans can engage in improving maternal health and focusing on the first 1,000 days. And there's all kinds of ministries and even government U.S. government efforts in that direction. And so I appreciate you linking these issues for us, because I think that oftentimes, the way we in the West think about children and childbirth and all things related to babies is so disconnected from the reality that other women around the world are experiencing, and certainly the realities into which other children around the world are being born. I just appreciate the linkage between justice and babies and maternal health and human suffering. And I mean, I just felt like the threads that you were not just pulling, but the threads that you were then knitting together for us in this book, Birthing Hope, were really profound.
Thank you so much.
So, friends, the author is Rachel Marie Stone. The book is Birthing Hope. If you would like to enter a drawing for a copy, you can either call or text us here in the studio, 877-933-2484. That's 877-93-FAITH. You're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm Carmen LaBerge, and we'll be right back. Hey, friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. Let's spend a little time making the connecting point. I'm hoping that as you listened to my conversation with Rachel Marie Stone, you were thinking to yourself, you know, there are some women out there dealing with concerns and issues that I have not spent a lot of time thinking about, or I might have only thought about from my own cultural perspective, or what we call social location. Like, I've only thought about what it's like to plan for and start a family from a North American perspective, a college-educated perspective, a churched perspective, a perspective of somebody who has generational support, the perspective of somebody who has a network of good relationships, a person who is married. I mean, go down the list of all of the ways in which you think about, hey, my husband and I were thinking about having a baby. Okay. So from a 21st century American perspective, that conversation is just radically different than the conversation that women of childbearing age around the world would even ever imagine was possible. And so I wanted to learn more about the experience of women around the world in relationship to what I would think of as like maternal health, but also the health related to newborn children. And so I ended up meeting Jenny Dyer, and she is the director of something called Hope Through Healing Hands. And you can check them out at hopethroughhealinghands.org. Hope for Healing Hands is a faith-based effort to actually initiate conversations and an actual on-the-ground ministry. And they might say, please don't use the word ministry when you talk about us, because what they're really focused on is making sure that the aid that is supplied by the U.S. government globally is being used in such a way to actually promote the kinds of things that you and I as Americans value, particularly Americans who are operating from a faith perspective. And so this particular effort, this faith-based coalition for healthy mothers and children, it works on one area, which I kept saying to her, okay, why aren't you just saying family planning? And she just bristles, because healthy timing and spacing of pregnancies is the language that we have to use and we have to learn how to use, because the language related to family planning has been so aligned with Planned Parenthood, and therefore we immediately think abortion, and that's just bad on all fronts. And so so how do we have conversations about supporting women around the world to have healthy timing and spacing of their pregnancies? And how do we focus then additionally on the health of not only the mother but the child through conversations about nutrition and food security, access to clean water, emergency relief, disease, I mean, on and on and on. So strategically, Hope Through Healing Hands works to encourage global health partnerships by working with leading organizations that actually are addressing these issues in developing nations, and then also working with faith communities to build a network through which we can actually help. Because I don't know about you, but it's so frustrating to know that women around the world of childbearing age would like to be in a position to say, hey, it's not healthy for me, it's not healthy for my family, it's not even healthy for my country, for me to have a baby every year, every single year, like clockwork. But I can't stop it from happening because I am not in a position to say no in terms of when the act might take place that creates the baby, nor am I in a position to have access to nor to be able to afford contraceptions. And so contraceptives. So let's talk about that. Evidence shows that delaying the timing and the spacing of pregnancies actually leads to the healthiest outcome, not only for women, but for their children, their families, their communities, and their countries. So I want you to think about that for a moment. And there may be some of you that are automatically thinking, this just doesn't sound pro-life. Well, if our pro-life position is that we're pro-life from conception to natural death, then we have to have a conversation about the morality of contraceptions, contraceptives, right? That which I would take to prevent myself from ever getting pregnant in the first place. That which would prevent me from conceiving. That's what we're talking about. We're not talking about abortifacients. We're not talking about something that you would take to that would result in an abortion, natural or other, or, you know, not natural is not the right word there, spontaneous or otherwise. What we're talking about here, we're not talking about chemical abortion. We're talking about genuine contraception through contraceptives, right? So we're going to counter conception, contra, that's what this word, just where this word comes from, by figuring out how to help women of childbearing age around the world be in a position to have access to healthy timing and spacing of pregnancies, which means they have to have access to modern contraceptives, as well as what we would consider natural family planning, fertility awareness, all of that. And so this is a critical issue, and you might have heard about campaigns related to the first 1,000 days. So the first 1,000 days during a pregnancy would include the first 2 years of a child's life. It also includes, you know, the moment of conception through the prenatal time, right? So spacing pregnancies out gives the woman's body time to recover. It gives the child enough time to actually develop. It makes it possible for the mother to breastfeed the child, which we all know is a good and healthy way to go if it's at all possible. And so there's also evidence that if a mom of childbearing age can delay her first pregnancy until she's 18, the health outcomes not only for that woman, but for not only her first child, but for every child she has after that, for her family, for her community and her nation, the statistics are just incredible. So if you want to know more about this, because I want you to actually know, have the information, not just what Carmen has to say about these things. But I want you to go to hopethroughhealinghands.org, hopethroughhealinghands.org. I want you to read the material there, like read the statistical information about women of childbearing age around the world. And then read the stuff about what does it look like for us to focus on timing and spacing in terms of pregnancies. World Vision is an active participant, not only in this conversation, but in helping faith leaders and faith communities understand and participate in this work. And I think that if we can get to the place where we can genuinely improve people's ability to improve their own lives simply by helping them understand healthy timing and spacing of pregnancies, and then help them achieve that through the availability of contraceptives. And you're saying to yourself, okay, the whole idea of preventing a pregnancy makes me uncomfortable. Okay, why? I want you to think about your own experience. I want you to think about your own family. I want you to think about your own family planning when it came to actually deciding with whom, when, and how often you were going to have babies. 200,000 women in the world right now, they don't have access to the contraceptives that they are interested in having, simply because they're in poverty. Millions of other women do not have the ability to make the decision about the first question, and that would be the question about who is going to be with or without their consent, performing the act that makes babies. I'm trying to be careful here for sensitive ears that might be traveling with you while you're listening to today's program. So by working together with faith-based organizations, these family planning efforts, particularly in Africa. So let's think about places in the world where America sends a lot of aid and a lot of aid workers, where organizations like World Vision are very active, where HIV/AIDS has been not eradicated, but is very, very successfully being combated because of efforts by the United States since the days of George W. Bush. And so we think about the progress that we've made, the network of medical relationships, medical organizations that we have in throughout the continent of Africa. We think about the relationships and networks of faith-based organizations that we have across the continent of Africa, and new technologies, new innovations, the driving down of cost of these kinds of contraceptives that we're talking about. And we reach the place in a conversation where we can say, you know what? If we would simply all help make this happen, you know, we would help these women and these communities not have to suffer in the ways that we sometimes see them suffer. Let's say when there is a drought that then produces widespread famine. You know, the truth of the matter is, if in those places there was a more healthy timing and spacing of pregnancies, everybody would be healthier when the drought occurs, and there would, in all likelihood, be fewer people who were looking for sustenance in the midst of the drought. So I am not talking about population control. I am talking about individuals being provided the information and access that they are interested in having to the latest contraceptives that you and I simply, you know, frankly, take for granted in the West today. So Christianity and Islam, that might be one of the questions that you're saying to yourself right now. When we talk about faith-based conversations in Africa, we're not just talking about Christianity. We are certainly also talking about Islam. I think it's important for people to know that Christianity and Islam both support, you know, the concept of the health of the mother. The mom's important. I think there are still a lot of misperceptions. I think that dialogue is important. I think that when we talk about modern contraceptives or natural family planning or fertility awareness, messages that are related to these things need to come within the context of a community where, you know, in my community of college-educated, white, upper-middle-class people, we're going to have different conversations about the morality of contraceptives and contraceptive use than might be taking place in a community in sub-Saharan Africa where no one has anything beyond, let's say, a second or third grade education. So there's lots of conversations that need to take place in the context of the community, and they need to be with not only faith leaders but medical leaders who understand the kinds of issues and concerns and challenges that are faced in those communities by women of childbearing age. And the reason that I use that language is because we're not necessarily talking here about what you and I would consider adult women. We're talking largely here about girls who are 13 to 17 years old. And so when we're talking about them having the kind of information and access that we would take for granted here in the West, we are also talking about child marriage, and we're also talking about the victimization of very young girls. So I want you to go to hopethroughhealinghands.org and become better equipped. And I want you to engage with the government in the ways that Hope Through Healing Hands is engaging. Friends, this has been Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. I would love it if you would share today's show with someone else. And I want you to have a great weekend, and God bless.